The term October surprise gets tossed around a lot in the last few weeks of an election. It refers to a news event, possibly an orchestrated one, that affects the outcome of voting. It came into vogue after this moment on October 26, 1972.
We believe that peace is at hand.
That was Henry Kissinger speaking about the war in Vietnam. He was wrong. It didn't end for a few more years. But that announcement may have helped seal then-President Nixon's lead over George McGovern. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We're in October, the month where all sorts of real-life surprises could affect this election. It's been a long, bruising one, so we also have some really cool stuff to give your brain a break. Like this. That's advertising. I'm going to explain later. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. In the world of finance, the terms long and short get thrown around a lot. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. We like to take those terms and apply them to the world of news. This week, we have 538's politics editor, Micah Cohen, and Marketplace's own Andy Euler. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lizzie. Good to be here.
I'm so glad you guys are here. Okay, Micah, I am going to let you roll out your long first because, you know, you're the guest. So go for it.
So my long is going to be North Carolina. I am betting on the importance of North Carolina. And here's why. Recent polls, basically since the first presidential debate, have shown Clinton gaining in North Carolina. And gaining there for her is more important in a lot of ways than gaining in another state.
Why?
The reason is basically that the states tend to move together. For example, if on election day you wake up and you see that you didn't follow any of the returns and you see that Clinton beat her polls in Pennsylvania, well, the odds are that she also beat her polls in Ohio then, right? Or in Michigan. All these states in the Midwest are pretty similar demographically, politically, culturally, right? North Carolina, though, is pretty different among the swing states. You know, you have a large African-American population. You have a lot of well-educated white voters in the research triangle. And that diversity, it's kind of a hedge against the Midwest. Let's just imagine that Trump support among non-college educated voters is way higher than we think it's going to be. That would really help him in the Midwest. But with North Carolina in her pocket, Clinton has a hedge against that. And so it opens up many more electoral college scenarios. So Trump is in a lot of trouble right now if he can't hang on to North Carolina.
All right. I'm gonna turn this segment around, although I will let us steer back to the election in a second. Andy, I want you to talk about your long, because there are parts of this that I found depressing, at least the underlying research. So
okay.
Go ahead.
I'm actually long on globalization. And I know
which
that's
is novel in this election year.
I was going to say that's counter to everything you're hearing from both campaigns. I'm actually long on globalization because, you know, I think global trade's been under attack for about 15 years. And then the Obama administration is trying to pass these massive, you know, partnerships, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's also the Transatlantic Partnership. I mean, the Obama administration was trying to get these massive deals done. And I think maybe they were swinging for the fences. But I think ultimately what's going to end up happening is we're going to realize that this is a global economy and global growth depends on it. I think we're just going to kind of see that come to fruition in the next 4 years.
But the reason I said that sure. I was sort of depressed by some of this stuff was that the underlying stats that we got from the IMF this week are about like 3% global growth. It's
right.
Not great looking. And they basically said everybody needs to kind of row together to keep growth moving forward. Yours is a long-term long.
It is a pretty long-term long. You're right. But it's also that, you know, I talked to a bunch of folks about what the IMF was going to talk about. I talked to folks this week that said, look, for the last 2-3 decades, what had been happening at the IMF specifically was everybody would get around the table and stare at the United States and say, we need you guys to invest a lot in our countries. And now that's just not the reality. That's not what's happening because we're trying to – I think a lot of people are talking about the massive amount of debt that the United States is in. So now our politicians and our policymakers are saying, look, we're not going to do that anymore. And so I think what's going to end up happening is other countries are going to have to participate in that globalization more and not just kind of sit at the table and look at the United States anymore.
All right. So now we're going back to the election for Mike.
Yeah,
I hate to drag us back to the election.
Hit it, man.
This actually relates to globalization where, you know, we've heard a lot of talk about, you know, Donald Trump's anti-trade, anti-globalization, quote unquote, America first policy and how well that's playing with, quote unquote, working class voters in the U.S. You know, the buzzword you always hear is white working class voters.
Right.
But I'm going short on Donald Trump and white voters.
Really?
Yeah. If you look at the numbers, Donald Trump is actually doing worse among white voters than Mitt Romney did. That's a really worrying sign for him because he's also doing worse among non-white voters.
Like zero African-American support.
Yeah, it is minuscule. His Hispanic support is going to be lower than Romney's, and Romney's was terrible. So Donald Trump is basically making a trade-off where he does overperform relative to past Republican nominees with non-college-educated white voters. The flip side of that coin is he underperforms with college-educated white voters. And right now, that trade-off is a net negative for him. If you take an average of the last five live interview polls, Trump is leading among white voters overall by 13 percentage points. That's worse than Romney did. Romney in 2012 carried that group by 17 points. So the math just kind of doesn't work out for Trump right now. He's sort of underperforming his benchmarks with white voters. He's way underperforming Republican benchmarks with non-white voters. And between those two groups, there's not really anyone left.
I'm leaving our election coverage there for the moment because I know that Andy is taking us a very different direction.
Okay, so I'm short on synthetic rhino horns, which you guys, I'm sure, have all read about.
I talk about
You took my short, Andy. That was my short.
So I was reading about this the last couple of days. And I was going to be long on it because I was super excited because, you know, the idea is we can fabricate rhino horns using rhino DNA and printing them with, I'm not kidding, 3D printers. You can make rhino horns that their DNA is the same and they look and feel and are actually genetically the same as rhino horns. So, okay.
Wow.
I'm thinking this is awesome. You know, we're not going to have any more poaching. We're not going to have it. So I talked to an old professor of mine who actually specializes in this, and he said there are actually petitions to not allow these synthetic rhino horns anymore or even the development of them because the idea is that it's going to increase demand of real rhino horns, that folks who believe that it has lots of medicinal powers and things like that, they're going to want the real thing. And so what it's going to do is place higher value on poached rhino horns. And so I just don't think – I think it's such a marketplace bummer because it's the market working. It's that the demand for this thing is going to go up because if you have all this synthetic, you know, these horns, it's like, no, I want the real thing. So I'm willing to pay, you know, $100,000 for a poached rhino horn, which is a total bummer.
Absolute law of unintended consequences
right?
playing out there. Thank you, Andy Euler, for introducing the single most depressing short that has ever been aired on this radio show.
Well, I assume there's a crown.
You get a rhino horn, a real one, not one of those fake ones.
Andy Euler from Marketplace, Micah Cohen from 538. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you.
We talked about the election in our long and short segment with Andy Euler and Micah Cohen. Now, sticking to the premise of our show, where the election meets real life. We wanted to bring you some opinions from the home of the second presidential debate, St. Louis. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams went to St. Louis, where she was born and raised, to talk to people there about what they think of the election and the candidates. Kimberly met up with some locals at Ted Drew's, which is famous for its frozen custard. Don't even think about calling it ice cream. Here are some of the voices from her reporting.
I will probably regret whoever I vote for, but I will vote. She seems like she has a little bit more understanding about what she's doing. Trump seems to kind of like have a good message, but he doesn't really seem to be able to back it up in any kind of way. He kind of just uses his I'm a billion-dollar businessman. He doesn't really go into any real detail. Kind of just want to hear like what they want to do, you know, to keep, you know, we've kind of dug ourselves out of a hole that we've been in the last couple years, and just see how we can progress from that and not fall back into the same hole we were in.
And I want to know what they're going to do for the senior citizens to keep us going.
What do you want them to do?
Well, I don't know. We haven't gotten a raise in our Social Security for I don't know how many years now. They think that our cost of living hasn't gone up. I don't know.
Has it gone up?
Are you kidding? Just because gas went down doesn't mean everything else in the universe hasn't gone up.
I wouldn't vote for Hillary. Sorry. But I just don't trust her.
Would you vote for Trump?
I'm going to have to because there isn't anybody else. And I think you need somebody who understands money. If you don't understand how money works, that's what they need. They need somebody that understands what to do with the money and how to get it.
I haven't really picked one yet. I think that I'm fall into that position to where I'm not happy with either one, totally. And I've been through some. You know, I'm old enough to see other presidential candidates and other elections. And this one I don't like as much because it's not as easy to pick anymore.
That was Lewis Meyer, Laureen Rush, Dan Rush, and Travis Dillon talking with our Kimberly Adams. One of the signature things about Marketplace, we like to do the numbers. And every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills with some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$38,100.
That's the median home value in Detroit, according to Zillow.
And in that devastated housing market, cash is king.
Mortgages have all but disappeared from the city. Instead, many international investors are buying up property and renting it out. We'll be hearing more about Detroit's housing market later in the show.
$1,800.
That's the difference in price for the same Princeton Review SAT course in two different counties, one in Dallas, the other in Queens.
Those numbers come from a new ProPublica investigation looking into how companies charge users differently based on what they can glean from consumer data.
ProPublica found the test prep cost more in low-income neighborhoods and in neighborhoods with a high Asian population.
$915 million.
You've probably heard that number a lot this week. It's the loss presidential candidate Donald Trump declared on his 1995 tax return, which may have let him off the tax-paying hook for 18 years.
It's important to note that if Trump did do that, it'd be completely legal under a lot of tax benefits real estate professionals enjoy.
However, his explanation for avoiding taxes, that he had a fiduciary responsibility to himself and to his businesses, doesn't quite hold up to legal scrutiny.
A couple of weeks ago, we wondered this. What if you always wanted to know about money, but have been afraid to ask? We got questions about 401ks, federal spending, and then actual literal money. To answer those questions, which you're about to hear, we called up Felix Martin. He's a macroeconomist and fund manager, and we got him on the line in London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We had these questions from our listeners that I think get to some of the fundamentals of money, which you have studied and written about. So what I'm going to do is ask you about them. But first, I want to actually play some clips from our listeners. This is the first one from Sam Kovac Orr, who is asking essentially, why do we still have cash?
I'm curious what the deal with the U.S. continuing to use physical currency is. It's kind of bugged me that a lot of businesses are cash only, and I feel like there would be a lot of benefits to moving to all digital transactions.
Felix, you are not only someone who's written about this, but also a macroeconomist. Could we just get rid of cash?
most of us have access pretty easily to various sorts of information technology these days, amongst which, for example, are debit cards and even contactless debit cards, which are used a lot these days. So it's a very valid question. Why do we still need this particular way of representing money and making payments with cash, coins, and notes? The issues are this. First of all, some people don't have access to bank accounts. You've got to remember that. Even in wealthy countries like the US and the UK, there are a lot of people who don't have bank accounts. And for those people, cash is a more convenient option. A second issue is that one has to remember there is something very important and different about cash from electronic forms of money. Any electronic form of money has to be linked to a bank account, which means that there is somewhere a centralized record of your credit balances and all the transactions that you're making, whereas cash is basically an anonymous system of payments. And that's quite an important issue, potentially, for civil liberties. Finally, I'm going to flip that round to say, make an argument which has recently been made by Kenneth Rogoff of Harvard University, who has made the case for abolishing cash for exactly the opposite reason. He says, well, it would be good if the government had the option of knowing more about our transactions, because that would prevent the use of cash for illegal transactions. So it's a question of whether you think that that is a price worth paying for the rest of us to enjoy the civil liberty of not having someone know what all our transactions are. Personally, if you want my view, I think it's a very important aspect of cash, and I think it's one of the reasons why it still is very popular, and I think it's something that we should try to preserve.
I'm going to flip this to sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, which is from another one of our listeners, Ed Morrell, who basically called in to say, hey, why don't we here in the U.S. have as much of a coin-based system as you do in the U.K.? I want to play that one.
Why hasn't the dollar coin ever really caught on? They seem to have released several of them into circulation over the years. They only seem to be used by, like, transit machines, and that's about it. Why don't people use them?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's also a good question. I do remember, of course, when I was growing up here in the U.K., we had the pound note. And then at a certain point, we switched to pound coins, nice little gold-colored coins, which we use today. And there are no pound notes anymore. The smallest denomination you can get in notes is a five-pound note. Whereas, of course, in the U.S., the dollar bill is still around, the dollar bill. And as your listener said, the dollar coin never seems to have caught on. The interesting thing about it is that it's probably more costly to produce bank notes. And I remember at the time that was a reason that was given for switching to coins in the case of the switch from the pound note to the pound coin.
Well, there's also a phenomenon that happened here when the dollar coins were rolled out is that notes were still in circulation. It seems to me if you want the public to go one way or another, you have to fiddle with supply and demand. Otherwise, you're not actually going to change the market.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of truth in that, especially with something like cash representing money, which is it's such a widely held habit that you're right, you need to nudge people in the direction you want them to go, or even by abolishing the notes, of course, you're nudging them quite severely, not really giving them any other option at all.
All right, I'm going to end by asking you one terribly easy question. You didn't write a whole book on it or anything. Felix, what's money?
Well, the simple answer is it's not a thing. If there's one thing I always want people to understand about money is that it isn't a thing that you can own. It's easy to get in the habit of thinking that money is a thing like a car or a house that you can own, but it's not. When you think about it clearly, money is a credit balance, and all these things we've been discussing, like coins and notes and other things, they're just ways of representing some credit balance that you have versus someone else, and usually it's versus your bank where you hold your deposits. And that very, very simple idea that money is a form of credit rather than a thing has lots of very important implications for everything from macroeconomic policy to the way that we personally think about money in our lives. But I think to tell you everything about what I think they are would take us far too long, but I can direct your listeners, of course, to my book.
Felix Martin is an economist and author of Money, the Unauthorized Biography. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For next week's conversation, Halloween can be quite the production. candy, costumes, decorations, parties. And we wanted to know, how do you spend on Halloween? Do you buy a lot? Do you make stuff? One year, my brother and I made Blair Witch figurines, and we scared ourselves so badly that we had to take them down the next day. Tell us about all your stories and traditions. Visit Marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us, 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Often when we talk to listeners, like in that last segment, we talk about housing. The U.S. housing market is in recovery, and home prices are on the rise nationally. But in Detroit, the median home value is still far below what it used to be. Houses are selling for $30,000 or $40,000, or for the tens of thousands of houses in foreclosure, even less. At the same time, though, getting a mortgage in Detroit has gotten harder. That's a pattern that goes back to the origins of institutional racism in the housing market. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has the story.
Hardly anyone in Detroit gets a mortgage. And that's common knowledge. Like, I meet this woman, Simone Thomas, kind of randomly. She and a couple of friends are drinking out of plastic cups on a friend's front porch on the northwest side. And I start asking her about her neighborhood, Highland Park.
And there's some beautiful homes in Highland Park, though. Beautiful homes. I'm talking about big family homes.
And she says these can be really affordable houses, too, $30,000 or $40,000.
But I definitely want a home because I have a son, and I want him to have his own backyard, you know?
But when a home sells in her neighborhood, it's almost always in cash. And that's common. In Detroit, where the median home price is below $40,000, there were fewer than 500 home loans out of almost 8,000 home sales in 2014. And it's not just Detroit. An Urban Institute study looked at 10 other cities where small loans have declined even as the number of cheap homes went up. The reasons for the disappearing mortgages are complicated. One is that a lot of people's credit and wages have been battered by the recession, so it's hard to qualify for loans. Take Simone.
I mean, I'm definitely looking into it, though. My finances aren't that great, but I have awesome credit. But my income is just not that right now.
But it also has to do with the institutions, the lenders, brokers, and insurers who market and sell these products. Linda Smith with the housing development group USnapBack says there's not a lot of money in a $30,000 mortgage.
Because realtors in Detroit haven't been able to make money. They kind of went, they didn't go away, but they were not actively trying to do mortgages.
This absence of financial services and lending institutions in low-income Black neighborhoods is nothing new. It goes all the way back to the 1930s, to historical redlining. That was when the U.S. government made maps delineating which areas were safe to lend in and literally put red ink all over Black neighborhoods that said, don't lend or invest here. And today, a map of Detroit shows a pattern of no lending in the same places that were originally redlined. The same is true in Milwaukee, St. Louis, Dayton. The only time that's ever sort of let up was during the subprime boom. Tim Ross heads a Michigan lender called Ross Mortgage in a shiny suburban building up the highway from Detroit.
Independents like ourselves have to make a business decision as to whether or not we choose to make that investment in certain communities.
His company made 432 loans in Wayne County in 2015, but only 15 of those were in Detroit proper. And out of those, zero were in the under 50,000 range. He says it's a combination of the costs of regulatory compliance and disinterest from brokers in marketing to areas where the homes are super cheap.
It's difficult to make a loan of that size and earn an appropriate amount of income to be able to pay the bill.
Plus, there are issues with the appraised values of the houses compared to what it would actually cost to fix them up. So many weren't maintained in foreclosures and have become unlivable. The woman from the porch, Simone Thomas, and her friends say homeownership also just seems risky. They're already buried in water bills, electric bills, Detroit's sky-high car insurance.
That's why we drink and smoke so much, because we're stressed out about these bills. That is the realest.
She saw what happened with the foreclosure crisis and would rather keep paying rent than risk losing everything. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
We often like to talk with musicians, actors, writers, and other notable people about work and money to hear their stories and share the lessons they've learned. We call it the Marketplace Quiz. This week, let's do some electronic indie pop.
Hey, I'm Nick.
I'm Amelia.
We are in the band Sylvan SO.
And we just released a new single. It's called Radio.
And we're happy to be here.
Yeah. Okay, Nick. In your next life, what would your career be?
I'm enjoying this career pretty intensely. So it'd be tough not to just double up on this one.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Okay, so I can't do that.
No.
Do you go personal interest, or do you go humanitarian aid that you wish you would have provided in this lifetime?
No. Have fun.
I would really love to be good at designing fonts.
That is a great option.
I'm really a big fan of the subtlety of typography, and I think that spending a long time getting really good at understanding how the written word works would be a really fulfilling thing to do. All right, Amelia.
Yeah.
So everybody knows that money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you blank. What would your blank be?
Time with puppies.
Seriously, you're going to pick time with puppies? I feel like...
No, but that's true.
Close to happiness.
It does.
It can buy you things that bring you happiness.
Yeah, exactly. It can buy you records and, you know, time with your family.
Airplane tickets? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, darn tootin'.
So you would go with things that are kind of happiness enablers.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the whole drag about money.
I think we've gotten to the bottom of something here.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I'm just not a very fame-interested person. So a person on the street knowing who I am is kind of an anxiety-inducing experience for me.
I've observed that in you, yeah.
More than that, the thing nobody gets about being in a band is that it almost is never a profitable thing to do. I think that there's this misconception that if, you know, somebody on a website or a radio station or whatever is talking about you, that you are a rich and famous person who, you know, makes a lot of money and jet sets around.
Yeah.
And
no.
It's like, that's just not the case almost ever.
Yeah. Like, I still check out the price of toothpaste. And you never get to the point where you don't have to go to the DMV.
All right, I got one more for you.
Okay.
What advice do you wish that someone had given you before you started your career in music?
In general, I would have loved it if someone had just been kindly and delicately touching me on the elbow and being like, you employ these people. Don't worry about it. Just because people are telling you to do things doesn't mean you have to do them. Like, this is your business. It took me about 2 years to learn. And then once I had that, I was like... But there was 2 years that were very guilt-ridden because I was trying to appease people that worked for me.
But I feel like you still do. I mean, like you, I don't know, you're very nice.
Excuse me?
I think you're very nice.
It's not a question of being nice or not because I wouldn't fulfill what they wanted me to do, but I
right.
felt bad about it. How about you?
I wish I would have been given a better understanding of... just the ins and outs of the business that surrounds music. When I started, and for a very long time, I was just really passive towards the idea of business and music being connected. There's too many things to understand for somebody whose primary interest is making things.
Yeah, you know what's a weird idea? Monetizing your art.
Yeah, it's like they're not good bedfellows.
It's so strange that the largest chunk of money that we stand to earn as musicians is... when your song is synced to sell a product.
Isn't that weird?
Like when your song is put in a commercial.
That's
strange.
It's a tough relationship.
Very strange. And it's usually like, here's this song I wrote about my breakup in eighth grade, and now it's selling fabric softener.
Yeah.
I'm so happy. It bought half my house.
I wrote about my relationship with my mom, and now, how do you like this laptop? It's really a great laptop. Like those don't... Well, what is that?
Silvanesso's latest single, Radio, is out now. Been so inspired by someone that you wanted to follow in their footsteps? Or to flip that around, maybe you were looking for a role model and couldn't find one. Grace Bonney has written a book that she hopes will meet both those needs. It's called In the Company of Women, and it's a series of brief profiles with photography and illustrations of more than 100 women who make things, run businesses, and are entrepreneurs. Bonney runs a business herself, the wildly successful blog Design Sponge. I asked her how this book came together.
So the book originally began as people who ran very traditional businesses, who had a product, who were selling something, who had employees. And then I kept thinking about how for the first 6 years of my business, that wasn't how I ran things. I didn't have employees. I had nobody else to answer to. I wasn't delivering anything concrete, but I was still running a business. And so I kept thinking about the word business and expanding it a bit to involve creative practices. So people who are painters, sculptors, writers, people who work in politics, like Melissa Harris Perry is in the book. And for me, their path to finding their voice and sort of standing up and owning their space is just as important and as part of a business as traditional business structures. And to me, as a woman, I want to see every path that exists to get where I want to be.
So is this a guide?
It is. It's part guide, part sort of just a celebration of knowing these women exist.
How did you pick the women in this book?
It was sort of two different paths. This book began as a sticky note on top of my laptop that said, bold women. And it had a list of maybe 8 people that I admire for taking up space and being loud and having opinions. And in the design community, I think right now, women in particular are asked to be very soft and very subtle. And there's this sort of, you know, glamorization of women being delicate. And that's fine. And that's totally one of many options of being a woman. But that's not what gets me to get up out of bed and work really hard. And I had a list of people like Kathleen Hanna and Nikki Giovanni and people who just really sort of owned their voice. And so I started expanding that list and it became 100 people. And then I reached out to friends and people that I admired, as well as some of those 100, and said, who do you admire? Who are the people I should know about that I don't know about? And then the list expanded to probably 200 people. And that's way too much of a book. I wish it wasn't, but I had to cut that in half. And the primary factor that came to cutting it in half was diversity of story.
All of the interviews in here follow a somewhat exact template, right? You're asking the same questions. Why do that?
I mean, I've done Design Sponge for 12 years now, and we've run a business column for the majority of those years. And I find that if you don't sort of politely force people to answer the questions that I think are tougher to answer, they will avoid them. And so we created 2 questionnaires for this book, one that applied to people who ran creative practices, one that applied to people who had a more traditional business. And we gave them, I believe, 25 questions and said, you have to answer at least half of these. But 5 of them were non-negotiables. And those were the ones about mistakes, things that had gone wrong, sort of moments that have maybe you could see as a failure, but what did you actually learn from them? Because I didn't want this book to be just a highlight reel of everything right. That's gone right, because I don't learn anything from that. And I don't know if anyone does. I feel like I am most inspired and motivated when I hear that somebody else has stumbled, especially later in their career, like talking to Eileen Fisher and realizing that she still makes mistakes and has problems in her businesses this far in. It makes me feel a little bit calmer and a little bit better about myself when I know that you can be that far into a business and still have hurdles.
Is there something about that formal structure that you think pulls out the informal or that pulls out the weird? I mean, you have people who answered these questions with illustrations.
Yes, we do. We gave everybody the option to answer in illustrated or collage or photo form. And I thought more people would do that, but we actually only had a couple people do that. I think that sort of having some sort of structure and formality makes people feel comfortable to kind of work outside of the lines a little bit. I've found that when I give people a lot of space, they end up kind of shrinking in a bit more. But if you give people parameters, I think there's something about working within the lines that makes you feel like you want to push outside of them more. When we sent the questionnaires and when I talked to people in person, I really encouraged them to be open and to be honest. And I led with my own examples when we were talking in person to say, like, hey, here's something I I've done wrong or something I continually screw up, to kind of set the scene for this is a safe place to be open and to be vulnerable.
What do you continually screw up?
What don't I continually screw up?
That's not a real answer.
I am constantly struggling with how to be a good boss. I am an only child. For the better part of my business, I was the only writer and only person. And now that I oversee a small team of people, it's constantly stressful to have to tell other people who, let's be honest, none of us make a lot of money working online, to tell people who are giving you all their days and so many of their weekends and nights to say, like, you need to work better, that you need to try harder, or you need to expand your sphere of influences.
We do something similar to the structure in your book called the Marketplace Quiz, where we ask standard questions. And one of them is, when did you know that your current career, like, could be a real thing? When did you know?
I didn't. Well, let's be honest. I still don't know.
We've been doing this for 12 years.
But every year the internet changes and expectations change. And I constantly worry, can we keep everybody on staff? Can I pay everyone's salaries? So that's a whole other worry. But I think in 2008 was when I was writing on the side for a ton of home magazines, which was my dream come true. And then they all closed. It was just one after the other after the other. And A, I thought it was my fault. And then B, I thought this was my stable place. This was my dream job, was to eventually end up like in the halls of Condé Nast and, you know, have a reliable paycheck. And then when it became clear that wasn't the reliable, safe place I thought it would be, I started looking back at the blog and thinking, oh, maybe there's something here, that this is growing. I can be in control of it and run it in a way that I feel ethically comfortable with. And I think that's when I started to take it seriously and meet with financial advisors and lawyers and get my ducks in a row.
Do you think that women in particular lack for mentorship? I mean, I was looking at this book and wondering, is this a catalog of mentors or a catalog of people to be inspired by?
Yes and yes. I think that women in particular lack and struggle, especially for visibility of mentors. I think there's no shortage of inspiring men running corporations and even small-scale businesses that we're all very familiar with. But I don't think women are held up, especially visibly, in the same way, and especially women of color, differently abled women. You're not hearing their stories, but they are out there, which is the frustrating part. And I keep thinking back to when I was 13 and 14, and at that age, I was very interested in the idea of like running my own magazine or making a newspaper. I had no idea that there were any other women who had ever done anything like that. And I kept thinking, I just want this book to exist so that someone somewhere opens it and knows that's an option.
You aimed for and have a diversity of stories and paths in here. But is there anything unifying? Is there a universal experience, you know, even if it's small, of being a female entrepreneur?
Absolutely. One is funny and one I think is more profound. The first is that almost every single person, when I asked them the question, what did they want to be when they were a child, chose something related to performing, whether it was a dancer or a movie star. And I found that so interesting because I think part of owning a business is having to be the face of something. And that is a string that everybody had connecting them in some way. And the more profound lesson that I learned that connected everyone was, everyone has come to accept and let go of the concept of work-life balance because it doesn't exist. Everyone is always kind of seesawing back and forth. And I honestly thought when I set out to write this book, I would get the answer, like the secret to that. I would at the end of these interviews know the secret to work-life balance. And it was really sitting down with these women and them saying, oh, that doesn't exist. You're never going to get there. It is a make-believe place. Accept that you will always be wanting to be somewhere, whether it's home or work, a little bit longer than you get to. And so realizing that everyone from the ages of like 19 to 75 had given up on that concept, I walked away from this book feeling so much calmer and secure and cutting myself some slack.
Grace Bonney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Branding and advertising are all around us. Billboards, commercials, logos, we see them all the time. And hear them, too, sometimes without even knowing it. Like when the stranger next to you on an airplane powers up their laptop. Somewhere in your brain, you know that's Windows. Here are a few examples. A little quiz. Listen to these pieces of audio and see if you can tell where they're from. That's the default iPhone ringtone. That's HBO's Sonic ID. And, as most of our listeners know, this is Marketplace. Connor Moore is a musician who does sound design for brands. And we read about him in California Sunday Magazine.
He's worked with Amazon, PayPal, and Uber Rush. I asked him what exactly sonic branding is and what it does.
The way that I really like to think about it is that every brand has a personality. So we as sound designers, composers, how can we communicate that by using sound or voice or music? You know, you played all those sonic IDs. Another example is like Intel Inside. Everyone knows that. Or the THX sonic ID.
Yep.
But, you know, now we're moving into a space where we can really start to branch out, you know, create assets for things like product sounds, voice for products or voice for advertisements. They really all fall under the umbrella of sonic branding. And they should, you know, these are all opportunities to create a more cohesive brand experience that is both strategic and intentional.
I mean, I guess as a consumer, sometimes you're not thinking about the amount of work that, you know, went into something like that. But when you hear that HBO sound, it is priming your brain for like, okay, now I'm going to sit down and like really watch something fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it really inspires that kind of awe that sucks you into the cinematic experience. And, you know, that's it's a cool example you picked because I don't know if you remember, but, you know, I'm a kid from the 80s watching in you know, the mid-80s, HBO used to have this intro that they played before all their films, and it was this super dramatic intro that had this big, you know, score to it. It was about a minute long,
yeah.
But yeah. So they've actually,
kind of like,
you know,
swooped around.
Exactly. Totally takes me back. Very nostalgic moment. But they've actually continued that that DNA, if you will, that sonic theme, but in a much more subtle way today. So after you hear that initial sound logo that you played, it segues into a cue that, you know, was created in the early 80s. So, you know, it's really cool to see how some of these brands are evolving sound in more subtle ways, too.
I want to talk with you about a piece of your work. So we're going to play, I believe, a ringtone for the Amazon Fire phone. Let's play that. So you made that, right?
I was a creative director for that.
When you hear that noise, what does it evoke in you?
Serenity. You know, one thing that I think a lot of people dislike about ringtones is they're very jarring. You know, they can really grab people's attention in a negative way. So one of the things we tried to do was create a sense of wonder, but also of serenity. You know, we didn't want to jump out and become annoying to users.
You know, it didn't occur to me until I was preparing for this interview, but every time somebody's cell phone rings, I mean, that is, in a sense, advertising.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the audio version of a billboard.
Well, when you talk about the Fire phone, for example, okay, we played one ringtone, but then there is a whole suite of sounds that goes along with a product like that. Mm-hmm. Do you sit down as a creative director and think, this is the identity I want the phone to have? And how do you translate that into sound?
I mean, it's a whole process. You know, initially you go in and you go into a project discovery, right? Discovering what the brand is about, what the product is about. So you take, you know, concepts of their brand identity that has already been shaped, and you're also looking at, you know, taking cues from the visual experience or the industrial design in order to shape this through sounds. You know, the way that I see this is visual artists using type fonts or color schemes. We use timbre of instruments, keys in music or modes or melodies in order to create these color palettes. So, you know, it's really interesting, and it's a hard thing that I've learned over time is how can you create these feelings of, say, serenity, for example? What does that mean?
Well, because sound is so intimate, I think, in a way that other media aren't.
It is a very intimate thing. I think music has the ability to connect to people like most mediums don't. It's really impactful as far as like nostalgia or remembering an experience that you went through, and it takes you right back there. It also brings recall, brand recall. It's a very powerful tool for brands to use. You know, like you played the iPhone ringtone. I take Bart into the city every day, and you hear that, you know it's an Apple phone immediately. You hear a Nokia, you know, ringtone. You know that's a Nokia phone. So, you know, the intimacy of sound and music is a really powerful tool for brand recall.
How is this going to become even more important as we start to get more and more devices that
talk to each other. You know, I can imagine a universe in which your Samsung fridge talks to your phone, talks to your dishwasher.
Right, right. We're starting to move away from the visual user interface. You're seeing products like Amazon Echo come in. Moving forward, I think a lot of these devices are going to exist around us, and the way we're going to communicate them is by sound, you know, whether it be voice or sound design. Sound is going to become even more of a huge player in terms of product and technology. You know, we as experts in this field have to really be careful about how we create this and where it is used. Part of my job is to say, okay, we don't need 100 sounds. Let's do 10, you know, and just strip it back, because ultimately you don't want to have every device in your home telling you this, that, or the other, or beeping at you. You know, you want to be very selective of these things and do it tastefully.
What does it cost to make a great Sonic logo?
What we recommend is to, you know, people that work in this field is not to just approach it from a Sonic ID perspective necessarily. It's more of a bigger brand build out. There are clients certainly that come along and they just need a product sound, for example, or a Sonic ID. So we take those jobs on as well. The bigger projects that, you know, include Sonic ID, a bigger strategy, discovery process, as well as product sound, those type of projects can take upwards of a year and they can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars,
wow.
Right? Whereas smaller projects can certainly be in the tens of thousands.
One of the things you talked about with California Sunday Magazine was cars and the sound that, you know, electric vehicles make or will be making, which kind of blew my mind because, right, they don't sound like combustion engine cars. Can you explain the difference between, I don't know, what a Dodge Charger sounds like and a Nissan Leaf sounds like?
It's interesting because when you think about it, an internal combustion engine, some of them are very loud and very obnoxious. So this is an opportunity to create something more pleasant and branded to that particular car or that particular company. I think the Leaf is a really cool example. You know, they've done a lot of work with their actual internal sound UI as well, outside of the engine tone. And it's been a very strategic effort for them that I think they've had a lot of success with.
So when this thing rolls down the street, like, what am I going to hear? And will some part of my lizard brain know that it's a Nissan Leaf?
I think so, especially as the, you know, the landscape fills out a little bit more. The Nissan Leaf is a very lightweight engine tone. It's almost a whir, like kind of wind. And there's a lot of opportunity for the future of electric cars. As far as what do cars sound like, you know, going from internal combustion engines to kind of blue sky right now, we as composers and sound designers are pretty excited about what that could be.
Connor Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, I'm switching on that out-of-office thingy, and I'm going on vacation. David Lazarus will be sitting in to guest host. Also, we want to know, how do you spend on Halloween? Come share your stories and traditions by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman, with help this week from Cerise Castle. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.